the overflow house, bringing a bottle of bubbly along to cheer old Lipsy up, because she seemed so glum. What's got into her, son? And Rick cheered her up all right. Pim heard it going on. Thump, creak, and scream, while he crouched outside her door in his dressing gown, wondering whether they were fighting or pretending. Back in bed, he would hear Rick tiptoeing down the stairs, though Rick could tread as lightly as a cat. Till a morning came when Rick did not leave quietly at all. Not for Pim, not for the rest of the overflow boys, who were greatly excited to be woken by the clamour. Lipsy was bawling, and Rick was trying to quell her. But the nicer he was to her, the more unreasonable she became. "You made me to be a thief!" she was yelling between great big whoops while she took another gulp of air. "You made me thief to punish me! You a bad priest, Ricky Pim! You made me to steal! I was honest woman! I was a refugee, but I was honest woman!" Why did she speak as if it was all last year? "My father was honest man. My brother also was honest man. They was good men, not bad like me. You made me to steal until I was criminal like you. Maybe God punish you one day, Ricky Pim. Maybe he will make you to weep too. I hope he will. I hope. "Old Lipsy's having a touch of her wobblies, son," Rick explained to Pim, finding him on the stairs as he made to leave. "Slip in there and see if you can make her laugh with one of your stories. Is old Grimble feeding you up there?" "It's super," said Pim. "Your old man is seeing them right. Know that? The healthiest school in Britain, this is. Ask them at the ministry. Want a half crown? Well then." To reach Lipsy's bicycle, Pim used a walk he had acquired from Sefton Boyd. You kept your hands lightly linked behind your back, shoved your head forward, and fixed your eyes upon some vaguely pleasing object on the horizon. You stalked wide and high, smiling slightly, as if listening to other voices, which is how the flower of us wear authority. He was too small to sit on the tartan saddle, but a lady's bicycle has a hole and not a bar, as Sefton Boyd was always happy to point out. And Pim swayed through the hole, pumping his legs from side to side as he swung the handlebars between the rain-filled craters in the tarmac. "I am the official bicycle collector." To his right was the kitchen garden, where he and Lipsy had dug for victory. To his left, the coppice, where the German bomb had fallen, hurling bits of blackened twig against the window of the bedroom he shared with the Indian and the grocer's boy. But behind him, in his terrified imagination, was Sefton Boyd with his lictors in full cry, mimicking Lipsy at him because they knew he loved her.
"Where are you going, my little black market? What are you doing mit your sweetheart, my little black market, now she be dead?"
Ahead of him was the gate where he had waited for Mr. Cudlove, and to the left of the gate was the overflow house with its iron railings ripped away for the war effort, and a policeman standing in the gap. "I've been sent to collect my nature study book," said Pim to the policeman, looking him straight in the eye as he leaned Lipsy's bicycle against a brick post. Pim had lied to policemen before and knew you must look honest.
"Your nature book, have you?" said the policeman. "What's your name, then?"
"Pim, sir. I live here."
"Pim who?"
"Magnus."
"Hop along, then, Pim Magnus," said the policeman.
But Pim still walked slowly, refusing to show any sign of eagerness. Lipsy's silver-framed family was queued up on the bedside table, but Rick's heavy head dominated the lot of them, sensitive and political in its pigskin frame, and Rick's sage eyes followed him wherever he went. He opened Lipsy's wardrobe and breathed the smell of her. He shoved aside her frilly white dressing gown, her fur cape, and the camel-hair overcoat with pixie's hood that Rick had bought her in St. Moritz. From the back of her wardrobe, he pulled out her cardboard suitcase. He set it on the floor and opened it with the key she kept hidden in the Toby jug on the tiled mantelpiece, next to the soft toy chimp who was little Audrey, who laughed and laughed and laughed. He took out the book like a Bible that was written in little black sword blades, and the music books and reading books he didn't understand, and the passport with her picture in it when she was young, and the wads of letters in German from her sister Rachel, pronounced Rahel, who no longer wrote to her. And from the very bottom of the case, Rick's letters, tied into bundles with bits of harvest twine. Some he knew almost by heart, though he had difficulty unravelling the portent seething beneath their verbiage. It is a matter of weeks, no, days, my darling, before the present besetting clouds will be dispersed away as a permanency. Loft will have obtained my discharge, and you and I can enjoy our well-deserved reward. Look after that boy of mine, who regards you as a mother, and make sure he doesn't turn out airy-fairy. Your doubts regarding trust completely misplaced. You should not trouble your head, as it is a further worry to me here, waiting for the bugle summons, perhaps never to return. What is involved here will bring untold benefits to many, such as Wentworth. Don't go on at me about W or his wife. That woman is a professional troublemaker of the worst kind out. My regards to Ted Grimble, whom I consider a great educationist and headmaster. Tell him a further hundredweight of prunes on its way. He shall prepare kitchen for 2 gross, best fresh oranges also. Loft has got me out on 3 weeks compassionate, which means I recommence my basic from scratch if I am recalled. Regarding another matter, Muspole says to continue sending items as before. Please oblige quickly. Owing purely temporary problem of liquidity, this end, which is preventing decent people like Wentworth being seen right. If you don't send more fee checks immediately, you may as well send me back to prison and all the boys accepting purse as usual. And that's a fact. Talk about killing yourself is foolishness, with so many killing each other round the world in this senseless and tragic war. Muspole says if you send post restaurant express tomorrow, he will be at P.O. when they open Saturday, and send on to Wentworth immediately. Lipsy's letter, which he had left till last, was by contrast a marvel of conciseness. My dear darling Magnus, you must be good boy always, darling. Play your music, and be strong like a man to your father. I love you, Lipsy. Pym made a bundle of them, Lipsy's included, stuffed them inside his nature book, and the nature book inside his belt. He rode past the policeman slowly, feeling cat's claws on his back. The school boiler was a brick furnace built into the basement, fed by a chute in the kitchen yard. To approach the chute was a beatable offence. To burn paper was a quisling act, and sailors would drown for it. A fierce rain was blowing from the downs. The chalk hills were olive against the storm clouds. Standing before the open chute, shoulders high against his neck, Pym shoved the letters into it and watched them disappear. A dozen people must have seen him, staff and inmates, and some for sure were allies of Sefton Boyd. But the openness with which he had proceeded convinced them he was acting on authority. Certainly it convinced Pym. He shoved in the last letter, which was the one that told him to be strong, and walked away without once turning to see if he was being noticed. He needed the staff lavatory again. He needed his secret St. Moritz with its panel seclusion. He needed the secret majesty of its brass taps and mahogany-framed mirror. For Pym loved luxury, as only those can who have had love taken from them. He gained the forbidden staircase of the staff room. He reached the half-landing. The lavatory door was ajar. He pushed it, slipped inside, locked it behind him. He was alone. He stared at his face, making it harder, then softer, then harder. He ran the taps and washed his cheeks till they shone. His sudden isolation, added to the grandeur of his achievement, made him unique in his own eyes. His mind whirled with the vertigo of greatness. He was God. He was Hitler. He was Wentworth. He was the king of the green filing cabinet, TP's noble descendant. Henceforth nothing on earth need happen without his intervention. He took out his penknife, opened it and held its big blade uppermost before his face in the mirror, taking an Arthurian vow. By Excalibur, I swear. The lunch bell rang, but there was no roll call for lunch, and he was not hungry. He would never be hungry again. He was an immortal knight. He thought of cutting his throat, but his mission was too important. He thought of names. Who has the best family in the school? I have. The Pyms are crackerjack, and Prince Magnus is the fastest horse in the world. He pressed his cheek against the wood panelling, smelling cricket bats and Swiss forests. The knife was still in his hand. His eyes went hot and blurred. His ears sang. The divine voice inside him told him to look, and he saw the initials KS-B carved very deeply into the best panel. Stooping, he gathered the splinters at his feet and put them into the lavatory, where they floated. He pulled the plug, but they still floated. He left them there, went to the arts hut, and completed his Dornier bomber. All afternoon he waited, confident nothing had happened. I didn't do it. If I went back, it wouldn't be there. It was Mags in third form. It was Jameson, who owns a cookery. I saw him go in. An oik from the village did it. I saw him sneaking round the grounds with a dagger in his belt. His name is Wentworth. At evensong, he prayed that a German bomb would destroy the staff lavatory. None did. Next day, he presented Sefton Boyd with his greatest treasure, the koala bear Lipsy had given him after his appendix operation. In break, he buried his penknife in the loose earth behind the cricket pavilion. Or, as I would say today, cashed it. It was not until evening lineup that the full name of the Honourable Kenneth Sefton Boyd was called out in a voice of doom by the duty master, the sadist O'Malley. Mystified, the young nobleman was led to Mr. Grimble's study. Mystified himself, Pym watched him go. Whatever can they want him for? My best friend? The owner of my koala bear? The mahogany door closed. 80 pairs of eyes fixed upon its fine workmanship. Pym's also. Pym heard Mr. Grimble's voice. Then Sefton Boyd's, raised in protest. Then a great silence, while God's justice was administered, blow by blow. Counting, Pym felt cleansed and vindicated. So it wasn't Mags, it wasn't Jameson, and it wasn't me. Sefton Boyd did it himself. Otherwise he would not have been beaten. Justice, he was beginning to learn, is only as good as her servants. It had a hyphen, Sefton Boyd told him next day. Whoever did it gave us a hyphen, when we haven't got one. If I ever find the sod, I'll kill him. So will I, Pym promised loyally, and meant every word. Like Rick, he was learning to live on several planes at once. The art of it was to forget everything except the ground you stood on and the face you spoke from at that moment. The effects of Lipsy's death upon the young Pym were many, and not by any means all negative. Her demise entrenched him as a self-reliant person, confirming him in his knowledge that women were fickle and liable to sudden disappearances. He learned the great lesson of Rick's example, namely the importance of a respectable appearance. He learned that the only safety was in seeming legitimacy. He developed his determination to be a secret mover of life's events. It was Pym, for instance, who let down Mr. Grimble's tires and poured 3 6-pound bags of cooking salt into the swimming pool. But it was Pym who led the hunt for the culprit, too, throwing up many tantalizing clues and casting doubt on many solid reputations. With Lipsy gone, his love for Rick became once more unobstructed, and, better, he could love him from a distance, for Rick had once more disappeared. Had he gone back to prison, as he had promised Lipsy that he would? Had the police found the green filing cabinet? Pym did not know then, and Sid, I suspect by choice, does not know now. Army records grant Rick an abrupt discharge, 6 months before the period in question, referring the reader to the Criminal Records Office for an explanation. None is available, perhaps because Peirce had a friend who worked there, a lady who thought the world of him. Whatever the reason, Pym floated out alone once more, and had a fair amount of fun. For weekend leave, Ollie and Mr. Cudlub received him at their basement flat in Fulham, and pampered him in every imaginable way. Mr. Cudlove, fit as ever from his exercises, taught him how to wrestle. And when they all went out for a toot on the river together, Ollie wore ladies' clothes, and did a squeaky voice so well that only Pym and Mr. Cudlove in all the world ever knew there was a man inside them. For his longer holidays, Pym was obliged to trek over Cherry's vast estates with Sefton Boyd, listening to ever more awful stories about the great public school, of which he would soon become a member. How new boys were tied into laundry baskets and flung down flights of stone stairs, how they were harnessed to pony traps with fishhooks through their ears and made to haul the prefect round school yard. "My father's gone to prison and escaped," Pym told him in return. "He's got a pet jackdaw that looks after him." He imagined Rick in a cave on Dartmoor, with Sid and Meg taking in pies wrapped in a handkerchief, while the hounds sniffed his trail. "My father's in the Secret Service," Pym told him another time. "He's been tortured to death by the Gestapo, but I'm not allowed to say. His real name is Wentworth." Having surprised himself by this pronouncement, Pym worked on it. A different name and a gallant death suited Rick excellently. They gave him the class Pym was beginning to suspect he lacked, and made things right with Lipsy. So when Rick came bouncing back one day, not tortured or altered in any way, but accompanied by two jockeys, a box of nectarines, and a brand new mother with a feather in her hat, Pym thought seriously of working for the Gestapo, and wondered how you joined. And would have done so, too, for sure, had not the peace ungraciously robbed him of the chance. A last word is also needed here about Pym's politics during this instructive period. Churchill sulked and was too popular. De Gaulle, with his tilted pineapple head, was too much like Uncle Makepeace, while Roosevelt, with his stick and spectacles and wheelchair, was clearly Aunt Nell in disguise. Hitler was so wretchedly unloved that Pym had more than a fair regard for him. But it was Joseph Stalin whom he appointed to be his proxy father. Stalin neither sulked nor preached. He spent his time chuckling and playing with dogs and picking roses in news cinemas, while his loyal troops won the war for him in the snows of St. Moritz. Putting down his pen, Pym stared at what he had written, first in fear, then gradually in relief. Finally, he laughed. "I didn't break," he whispered. "I stayed above the fray." And poured himself a poppy-sized vodka for old time's sake. Chapter 5. Frau Bauer's bed was as narrow and lumpy as a servant's bed in a fairy tale, and Mary lay in it exactly as Brotherhood had dumped her there, roly-polied in the eiderdown, knees drawn up in self-protection, clutching her shoulders with her hands. He had slid off her. She could no longer smell his sweat and breath. But she could feel his bulk at the foot of the bed, and sometimes she had a hard time remembering that they had not made love a few moments earlier, for his habit in those days had been to leave her dozing while he sat as he was sitting now, making his phone calls, checking his expenses, or doing whatever else served to restore the order of his all-male life. He had found a tape recorder somewhere, and Georgie had a second in case his didn't work. For a hangman, Nigel was small but extremely dapper. He wore a wasted pinstripe suit, a silk handkerchief in his sleeve. "Ask Mary to make a voluntary statement, will you, Jack?" Nigel said, as if he did this every week. "Voluntary but formal is the tone. Could be used, I'm afraid. The decision is not Beau's alone." "Who the hell says voluntary?" said Brotherhood. "She signed the Official Secrets Act when she joined. She signed it again when she left. She signed it again when she married Pym. Everything you know is ours, Mary, whether you heard it on top of a bus or saw the smoking gun in his hand." "And your nice Georgie can witness it," said Nigel. Mary heard herself talking, but didn't understand a lot of what she said, because she had one ear in the pillow and the other was listening to the morning sounds of Lesbos through the open window of their little brown terrace house, halfway up the hill that Plomari was built on, to the clatter of mopeds and boats and bouzouki music and lorries revving in the alleys, to the scream of sheep having their throats cut at the butchers, and the slither of donkey hooves on cobble, and the yells of the vendors in the harbour market. If she squeezed her eyes tight enough, she could look over the orange rooftops across the street, past the chimneys and the clotheslines and the roof gardens full of geraniums, down to the waterfront, and out to the long jetty with its red light winking on the point, and its evil ginger cats soaking themselves in the sunshine, while they watched the tramper putter out of the mist. And that was how Mary saw her story henceforth, as she told it to Jack Brotherhood. A nightmarish film she dared look at only piecemeal, with herself as the meanest villain ever. The tramper draws alongside. The cats stretch. The gangway is lowered. The English family Pym, Magnus, Mary, and son Thomas file ashore in search of yet another perfect place away from it all. Because nowhere is far enough anymore. Nowhere is remote enough. The Pyms have become the Flying Dutchmen of the Aegean, scarcely landing before they pack again, changing boats and islands like driven souls, though only Magnus knows the curse. Only Magnus knows who is pursuing them and why. And Magnus has locked that secret behind his smile with all his others. She sees him striding gaily ahead of her, clutching his straw hat against the breeze, and his briefcase dangling from his other hand. She sees Tom stalking after him in the long grey flannels and school blazer, with his cub colours on the pocket, which he insists on wearing even when the temperature is in the 80s. And she sees herself, still doped with last night's drink and oil fumes, already planning to betray them both. And following them, in their bare feet, she sees the native bearers with the Pym's too much luggage, the towels and bed linen, and Tom's Weetabix, and all the other junk she packed in Vienna for their great sabbatical, as Magnus calls this once-in-a-lifetime family holiday, they have all apparently been dreaming of. Though Mary cannot remember it being mentioned until a few days before they left. And to be honest, she would rather have gone back to England, collected the dogs from the gardener and the long-haired Siamese from Aunt Tab, and spent the time in plush. The bearers set down their burdens. Magnus, generous as ever, tips each of them from Mary's handbag, while she holds it open for him. Stooped gawkily over the reception committee of Lesbos cats, Tom declares they have ears like celery. A whistle sounds. The bearers hop up the gangway. The tramper is returned to the mist. Magnus, Tom, and Mary the traitor stare after it like every sad story of the sea, their life's luggage dumped around them, and the red beacon dripping slow fire on their heads. "Can we go back to Vienna after this?" asks Tom. "I'd like to see Becky Lederer." Magnus does not answer him. Magnus is too busy being enthusiastic. He will be enthusiastic for his own funeral, and Mary loves him for this, as he loves him for too much else, does still. Sometimes his sheer goodness accuses me. "This is it, Mabs," he cries, waving an arm grandly at the treeless, conical hill of brown houses that is their newest home. "We found it, Plush sur Mer." And he turns to her with a smile she has not seen until this very holiday. So gallant, so tired bright in its despair. "We're safe here, Mabs. We're okay." He throws an arm round her. She lets him. He draws her into him. They hug. Tom squeezes between, an arm round each of them. "Hey, let me have some of that," he says. Locked together like the closest allies in the world, the three move off down the jetty, leaving their luggage till they have found a place to put it. Which they achieve within the hour. For clever Magnus knows just the right taverna to go to first time, whom to charm, and whom to recruit, in the surprisingly passable Greek identity he has somehow cobbled together for himself on their journeying. But there is the evening yet to come, and the evenings are getting worse and worse. They hang over her from when she wakes. She can feel them creeping up on her all through her day. To celebrate their new home, Magnus has bought a bottle of Stolichnaya vodka, though they have agreed several times in the last few days to lay off the hard stuff and stick to local wine. The bottle is nearly empty, and Tom, thank God, is finally asleep in his new bedroom. Or so Mary prays. For Tom has recently become a fag ender, as her father would have said, hanging around them for whatever he can pick up. "Hey, come on, Mabs! That's a bit of a bad face, isn't it?" says Magnus, jollying her up. "Don't you like our new schloss?" "You were being funny, and I smiled." "Didn't look like a smile," says Magnus, smiling himself to show her how. "More like a bit of a grimace from where I sit, my dear." But Mary's blood is rising, and as usual she cannot stop herself. The prospect of her uncommitted crime is already laying its guilt on her. "That's what you're writing about, is it?" she snapped. "How you waste your wit on the wrong woman." Appalled by her own unpleasantness, Mary bursts out weeping, and drives her fists on to the arms of the rush chair, But Magnus is not appalled at all. Magnus puts down his glass and comes to her. He taps her gently on the arm with his fingertips, waiting to be let in. He puts her glass delicately out of reach. Moments later, the springs of their new bed are pinging and whining like a brass band tuning up, for a desperate, erotic fervour has latterly come to Magnus's aid. He makes love to her, as if he will never see her again. He buries himself in her, as if she is his only refuge, and Mary goes with him blindly. She climbs. He draws her after him. She is shouting at him, "Please, oh Christ!" He hits the mark for her, and for a blessed moment, Mary can kiss the whole bloody world goodbye. "We're using Pembroke, by the way," Magnus says later, but not quite late enough. "I'm sure it's unnecessary, but I want to be on the safe side in case." Pembroke is one of Magnus's work names. He keeps the Pembroke passport in his briefcase. She has already located it. It has an artfully muddy photograph that might be Magnus or might not. In the forgery workshop in Berlin, they used to call photographs like that floaters. "What do I tell Tom?" she asks.
"Why tell him anything?"
"Our son's name is Pym. He might take a little oddly to being told he's Pembroke." She waits, hating herself for her intractability. It is not often that Magnus has to hunt for an answer, even when it concerns guidance on how to deceive their child. But he hunts now. She can feel him do it as he lies wakefully beside her in the dark. "Yes, well, tell him the Pembrokes own the house we're in, I should. We're using their name to order things from the shop. Only, if asked, naturally." "Naturally. Those two men are still there," says Tom from the door, who turns out to have been part of their conversation all this while.
"What men?"
says Mary. But her skin is pricking on her nape. Her body is clammy with panic.
How much has Tom heard, seen?
"The ones who are mending their motorbike by the river. They've got special army sleeping bags and a torch and a special tent.
There are campers all over the island," says Mary. "Go back to bed."
"They were on our ship too," says Tom, "behind the lifeboat, playing cards, watching us, speaking German."
"Lots of people were on the ship," says Mary.
"Why don't you say something, you bastard?"
she screams at Magnus in her head.
"Why do you lie dead instead of helping me when I'm still wet from you?"
With Tom on one side, Magnus on the other, Mary listens to the bells of Plumari tolling out the hours.
4 more days, she tells herself. On Sunday, Tom flies back to London for the new school term. And on Monday, I'll do it, and be damned.
Brotherhood was shaking her. Nigel had said something to him. Ask her about the beginning, pin her down.
"We want you to come back a stage, Mary. Can you do that? You're running ahead of yourself."
She heard murmuring, then the sound of Georgie changing a reel on her tape recorder. The murmuring was her own.
"Tell us how you came to be taking the holiday in the first place, will you, dear? Who proposed it?"
"Oh, Magnus, did he? I see. And was that here in this house?"
"It was."
"Now, what time of day would that have been? Sit up, will you?" So Mary sat up and began again, where Jack had told her. On a sweet, early summer's evening in Vienna, when everything was still absolutely fine, and neither Lesbos nor all the islands that came before it were a glint in clever Magnus's eye. Mary was in the basement in her overalls, binding a first edition of Die letzten Tage der Menschheit by Karl Kraus, which Magnus had found in Leoben while meeting a Joe there, and Mary...
"That a regular one, Leoben?"
"Yes, Jack, Leoben was regular."
"How often did he go there?"
"Twice a month. 3 times. It was an old Hungarian he had, no one special."
"He told you that, did he? I thought he kept his Joes to himself."
"An old Hungarian wine dealer from way back, with offices in London and Budapest. Mostly Magnus kept his secrets to himself. Sometimes he told me. Now, can I go on?"
"Tom was at school. Frau Bauer was out praying," said Mary. It was some kind of Catholic bean feast. Assumption, ascension, prayer and repentance. Mary had lost count. Magnus was supposed to be at the American Embassy.
The new committee had just started meeting and she wasn't expecting him back till late. She was bang in the middle of gluing when suddenly, without her hearing a sound, she saw him standing in the doorway. God knows how long he'd been there, looking very pleased with himself, and watching her the way he liked to. "How was that, dear? Watched you how?" Brotherhood cut in. Mary had surprised herself. She faltered. "Superior, somehow. Pained superiority. Jack, don't make me hate him, please."
"All right, he's watching you," said Brotherhood.
"He is watching her, and when she catches sight of him, he bursts out laughing and shuts her mouth with passionate kisses, doing his Fred Astaire number. Then it's upstairs for a full and frank exchange of views, as he calls it. They make love. He hauls her to the bath, washes her, hauls her out and dries her. And 20 minutes later, Mary and Magnus are bounding across the little park on the top of Derbling, like the happy couple they nearly are. Past the sandpits and the climbing frame that Tom is too big for. Past the elephant cage, where Tom kicks his football. Down the hill towards the restaurant Tehran, which is their improbable pub, because Magnus so adores the black-and-white videos of Arab romances they play for you, with the sound down, while you eat your couscous and drink your kaltara. At the table, he holds her arm fiercely, and she can feel his excitement racing through her like a charge, as if having her has made him want her more. "Let's get away, Mabs. Let's really get away. Let's live life for a change instead of acting it. Let's take Tom and all our mid-tour leave and bugger off for the whole of the summer. You paint, I'll write my book, and we'll make love until we fall apart. Mary says where to, Magnus says who cares. I'll go to the travel agent at the Ring tomorrow. Mary says what about the new committee?" He is holding her hand inside his own, touching it with his fingertips into little peaks, and she is going mad for him again, which is what he likes. "The new committee, Mary," Magnus pronounces, "is the most stupid bloody charade I've ever been mixed up in. And believe me, I've seen a few. All it is, it's a talking shop to goose up the firm's ego and allow them to tell whoever will listen to them that we're hugger-mugger in bed with the Americans. Lederer can't possibly imagine we're going to unveil our networks to him. And as for Lederer, he wouldn't tell me the name of his tailor, let alone his agents. Assuming he's got either, which I doubt." Brotherhood again. "Did he tell you why Lederer mightn't be inclined to talk to him?"
"No,"
said Mary. "Nigel, for a change. And no other reasons offered as to why or how the committee might be a charade?"
"It was a charade. It was a sham. It was make-work. That's all he said. I asked about his Joes. He said the Joes could look after themselves. And if Jack was bothered about them, he could send a locum. I asked what Jack would think."
"And what would Jack think?" said Nigel, all open curiosity.
"He said Jack's a sham, too. I'm not married to Jack, I'm married to you. The firm should have retired him 10 years ago. Sod Jack. Sorry, that's what he said."
Hands shoved in his pockets, Brotherhood took a stroll round the little room, poking at Frau Bauer's photographs of her illegitimate daughter, poring over her shelf of paperback romances. "Anything else about me?" he asked.
"Jack's had too many miles in the saddle. The Boy Scout era's over. It's a new scene and he's not up to it."
"Any more?" said Brotherhood. Nigel had lowered his chin into his hand and was studying one small but perfectly formed shoe.
"No," said Mary.
"Did he go for a walk that night? Meet P?"
"He'd been the night before."
"I said that night, answer the bloody question."
"And I said the night before."
"With a newspaper, the whole bid?"
"Yes."
His hands still in his pockets, his head high against his shoulders, Brotherhood turned stiffly to Nigel. "I'm going to tell her," he said. "You want to throw a fit?"
"Are you asking me formally?" Nigel asked.
"Not particularly."
"If you are, I'll have to pass it to Beau," said Nigel, and looked respectfully at his gold watch, as if he took orders from it, too.
"Lederer knows, and we know. If Pym knows, too, who's left?" Brotherhood insisted. Nigel thought about this. "Up to you. Your man, your decision, your tail end, frankly." Brotherhood leaned over Mary and put his head close to her ear. She remembered his smell, tweedy and paternal.
Listening?
She shook her head. I'm not. I never will be. I wish I never had.
The new committee that your Magnus derided was shaping up to be a very high-powered outfit. Maybe the best potential working relationship at field level that we've had with the Americans for years. The name of the game was mutual trust. Not as easy to establish these days as it used to be, but we managed it. Are you going to sleep?
She nodded. Your Magnus was not only aware of this, he was one of the prime movers in getting the committee off the ground, if not the prime mover. He even went so far as to complain to me, when we were negotiating the deal, that London was being small-minded in its interpretation of the barter terms. He thought we should give the Americans more, in exchange for more. That's number one.
I have absolutely nothing else to say. You can have my home address, my next of kin, and that's your lot. You taught me that yourself, Jack, in case they ever grabbed me.
Number two was that for reasons which I regarded at the time as specious and insulting, the Americans objected to your husband's presence on that committee not 3 weeks after it met, and asked me to replace him with somebody more to their liking. Since Magnus was kingpin of the Checo operation, and of several other little shows in Eastern Europe besides, this was a totally unrealistic demand. They'd raised the same objections about him in Washington the year before, and Beau had bowed to them, in my view mistakenly. I wasn't about to let them do it again. I happen not to care for American gentlemen, or anybody else telling me how to run my shop. I said no, and ordered Magnus to take himself off on mid-tour leave, and stay clear of Vienna till I told him to come back. That's the truth. And I think it's time you heard some.
It's also very secret, said Nigel.
She waited in vain to be amazed. No surge of protest, no flash of the celebrated family temper. Brotherhood had taken himself to the window and was staring out. Morning had come early because of the snow. He looked old and beaten. His white hair was fluffed against the light, and she could see the pink skin of his scalp.
You defended him, she said. You were loyal.
Seems as if I was a bloody fool as well. The house had turned itself upside down. The thump of shifting furniture came from below them in the drawing room.
The safest place to be was here, upstairs with Jack.
Oh, don't be so hard on yourself, Jack, Nigel said. Brotherhood had sat Mary in the chair and handed her a whiskey. You get only one, he had said. Make it last. Nigel had taken over the bed and was lounging on it, with one suited little leg stuck out in front of him, as if he'd sprained it trying to get up the steps of his club. Brotherhood had turned his back on both of them. He preferred the view from the window.
So first you go to Corfu. Your auntie has a house there. You borrowed it from her. Tell that bit. Carefully.
Aunt Tab, said Mary.
In full, I think, said Nigel.
Lady Tabitha Gray, Daddy's sister.
Sometime member of the firm, Brotherhood murmured to Nigel. There's hardly a member of her family hasn't been on our books at one time or another, come to think of it. She had telephoned Aunt Tab as soon as they had got back from their drink that evening, and by a miracle there'd been a cancellation, and her house was free. They took it, phoned Tom's school, and arranged for him to fly there direct when term ended. As soon as the letterers heard, they wanted to come too, of course. Grant said he would drop everything, but Magnus wouldn't hear of it. The letterers are exactly the kind of social prop I need to kick away, he had said. Why the hell should I take my work with me on holiday? 5 days later, they were settled into Tab's house, and everything was absolutely fine. Tom took tennis lessons at the hotel up the road, swam, fed the landlady's goats, and potted around the boat with Costas, who looked after it and watered the garden. But his best thing was the crazy cricket matches on the edge of town that Magnus took him to in the evenings. Magnus said the Brits had brought the game to the island when they were defending it against Napoleon. Magnus knew these things, or pretended to. At the cricket in Corfu, Magnus was closer to Tom than he had ever been. They lay on the grass, munched ice creams,
rooted for their favourite players, and had those mannish chats that were so crucial to Tom's happiness. For Tom loved Magnus to distraction. He was a man's boy, always had been. As to Mary, she had taken up pastels because Corfu in summer was really too hot for her style of watercolour. The paint dried on the page before she could get near it. But she was drawing well, getting nice likenesses and shapes, and playing hostess to half the dogs on the island because the Greeks don't feed them or look after them or anything. So everyone was happy, everyone absolutely fine, and Magnus had a cool conservatory to write in, and inland walks for his restlessness, which came to him first thing in the morning, and again in late evening, after he'd held it off all day. They lunched late, usually in a taverna, and often rather a liquid affair, to be honest. But why not? They were on holiday. Then long, sexy siestas, while Mary and Magnus made love on the balcony, and Tom lay on the beach, studying the nudies across the bay with Magnus's binoculars. So, as Magnus put it, everybody was getting his pound of flesh. Until one day the clock stopped dead, and Magnus came back from a late walk, and confessed he had hit a bit of a block with his writing. He just strode in, poured himself a stiff ouzo, flung himself into a chair, and said it straight out. Sorry, Mabs. Sorry, Tom, old chap, but this place is too damned idyllic. I need roughing up a bit. I need people, for Christ's sake. Smoke and dirt and a bit of suffering around us. It's like being on the moon here, Mabs. Worse than Vienna, truly. He was sweet about it, but he was adamant. He'd been drinking, obviously, but that was because he was upset. I'm going bonkers, Mabs. It's really getting to me. I told Tom, didn't I, Tom? I said I really can't take much more of this. And I feel shit, because you two are having such a good time. Yes, he did, said Tom, several times. And today it's just hit me, Mabs. You've got to help me out, both of you. So, of course, they both said they would. Mary rang Tab at once, so that she could put the house back on the market. They all had a bear hug, and went to bed feeling resolved. And next day, Mary packed, while Magnus went off to town to do tickets, and fix the next stage of their odyssey. But Tom, over washing up, which was always a talkative time for him, had a different version of why they were leaving Corfu. Daddy had met this mystery man at cricket. It was a really super match, Mum. The two best teams on the island. A real vendetta. We were watching it like mad, and suddenly there was this wise, stringy man with a sad moustache like a conjurer's, and limp. And Dad got all uptight. He came up to Dad, smiling. They talked a bit. They walked round and round the ground together, with the thin man going slowly like an invalid. But he was terribly kind to Dad, although Dad got so emanated. Animated, Mary corrected him automatically. Don't talk too loud, Tom. I think Daddy's working somewhere. And there was this really incredible batsman, said Tom, called Filippi. Just the absolute best batsman Tom had seen ever. He scored 18 in one over, and the crowd went absolutely ape. But Dad didn't notice. He was so busy listening to the kind man. How do you know he was so kind? Said Mary, with a strange irritation. Keep your voice down. There was no light in the conservatory, but sometimes Magnus sat there in the dark. He was like a father with him, Mum. He's senior to him, but sort of calm. He kept offering Dad a ride in his car. Dad kept saying no, but he didn't get angry or anything. He was too wise. He gentled him and smiled. What car? It's just a great big romance, Tom. You know it is. The Volvo. Mr. Kalumenis's Volvo. One man was driving and another man in the back. They kept up with them on the other side of the fence, when they went round and round, talking. Honestly, Mum, the thin man never lost his temper or anything. And he really likes Dad, you can tell. It's not just holding arms. They're friends to each other. Much more than Uncle Grant. More like Uncle Jack. Mary asked Magnus that night. They'd packed. She was excited to be moving, and really looking forward to the Athens museums. Tom says you were harassed by some tiresome man at the cricket match, said Mary, while they enjoyed a rather stiff nightcap after their heavy day. Was I? Some little man who chased you round and round the ground. Sounded like an angry husband to me. He had a moustache, unless Tom imagined it.
Then vaguely Magnus did remember. Oh, that's right, he was some boring ancient Brit who kept pressing me to go and see his villa, wanted to flog it. A bloody little pest, actually.
He spoke German, said Tom, next day at breakfast, while Magnus was out walking.
Who did?
Dad's thin friend, the man who picked Dad up at the cricket, and Dad spoke German back to him. Why did Dad say he was an ancient Brit?
Mary flew at him. She hadn't been so angry with him for years.
If you want to listen to our conversations, you bloody well come in and listen to them and don't skulk outside the door like a spy.
Then she was ashamed of herself and played tennis with him till the boat left.
On the boat, Tom was sick as a dog, and by the time they reached Piraeus, he had a temperature of 103, so her guilt was unconfined. At the Athens hospital, a Greek doctor diagnosed shrimp rash, which was absurd because Tom loathed shrimps and hadn't touched a single one. By now his face was swollen like a hamster's, so they took expensive rooms and put him to bed with an ice pack, and Mary read fantasy to him while Magnus listened or sat in Tom's room to write. But mainly he liked to listen, because the best thing in his life, he always said, was watching her comfort their child. She believed him.
Didn't he go out at all? Brotherhood asked.
Not to begin with. He didn't want to.
Make any phone calls, said Nigel.
The embassy to check in, so that you know where he was.
He'd tell you that, said Brotherhood.
Yes.
You weren't there when he made them, Nigel said.
No.
Hear him through the wall? Nigel again.
No.
Know who he spoke to? Still Nigel.
No.
From his place on the bed, Nigel lifted his eyes to Brotherhood. But he phoned you, Jag, he said encouragingly. Little chats from out-of-the-way places with his old boss now and then. That's practically mandatory, isn't it? Check on the Joes. How's our old buddy from you-know-where?
Nigel is one of the new non-professionals, Mary remembered Magnus telling her. He's one of the idiots who are supposed to be introducing a breath of Whitehall realism.
If ever I heard a contradiction in terms, that's it, Magnus had said.
Not a peep, Brotherhood was replying. All he did was send me a string of stupid postcards saying, thank God you're not here, and giving me his latest address.
When did he start going out? Said Nigel.
When Tom's temperature went down, Mary replied.
A week? Said Nigel, invitingly.
Two?
Less, said Mary.
Describe, said Brotherhood.
It was evening, probably their fourth day. Tom's face was normal again, so Magnus suggested Mary go shopping while he babysat Tom to give her a break. But Mary wasn't keen on braving the Athens streets alone, so Magnus went instead. Mary would do a museum in the morning. He came back around midnight, very pleased with himself, saying he'd found this marvellous old Greek travel agent in a basement opposite the Hilton, a tremendously cultured fellow, and how they had drunk ouzo together and solved the problems of the universe. The old man ran a villa renting service for the islands and hoped to turn up a cancellation in a week or so, when they'd all had enough of Athens.
I thought islands were out, Mary said.
For a moment it seemed that Magnus had forgotten the reason they had left Corfu. He smiled lamely and said something about not every island being the same. After that, she seemed to lose count of the days. They moved to a smaller hotel. Magnus wrote and wrote, went out in the evenings, and when Tom was well enough, took him swimming. Mary sketched the Acropolis and took Tom to a couple of museums, but he preferred swimming. Meanwhile, they waited for the old Greek to come up with something.
Brotherhood was once more interrupting. This writing of his, how much did he talk about it exactly?
He wanted to preserve his secrecy. Scraps. That was all he gave me.
Like his Joes. The same, Brotherhood suggested.
He wanted to keep me fresh for when he'd really got something to show me. He didn't want to talk it out of himself.
It was a quiet and, as Mary now remembered it, strangely furtive time, until one night Magnus vanished. He went out after dinner, saying he was going to give the old boy a prod.
Next morning he hadn't come back, and by lunchtime Mary was scared. She knew she should phone the embassy. On the other hand, she didn't want to start a scare unnecessarily, or do anything that might get Magnus into trouble. Yet again Brotherhood cut in. What sort of trouble? If he'd gone on a bender or something, it wouldn't exactly have looked well on his file, just when he was hoping for promotion. Had he gone on benders before? Absolutely not. He and Grant got drunk together occasionally, but that was as far as it went. Nigel sharply lifted his head. But why should he be expecting promotion? Who said anything about promotion to him? I did, said Brotherhood, without a whiff of repentance. I reckoned after all the messing him around, he was about owed it with his reinstatement. Nigel made a neat little note in his book, and smiled mirthlessly as he wrote. Mary went on. Anyway, she waited till evening, then took Tom up to the Hilton, and together they explored all the houses opposite until they found the cultured old Greek in his basement, exactly as Magnus had described him. But the Greek hadn't seen Magnus for a week, and Mary wouldn't stay for coffee. When they got back to the taverna, they found Magnus with 2 days' beard, dressed in the clothes he had disappeared in, sitting in the courtyard, and eating bacon and eggs. Drunk. Not silly drunk, he couldn't do that. Not angry drunk, or maudlin, or aggressive. And least of all, indiscreet. Because drink only ever fortified his defences. Courteous drunk, therefore, and amiable to a fault, as ever. And his cover story, perfectly intact, except for one rare mistake. Sorry, gang. Got a bit pissed with Dimitri. Swine drank me clean under the table. Hello, Tom. Hello, said Tom. Who's Dimitri? Mary asked. You know who Dimitri is. Old Greek travel agent who does his beads across the road from the Hilton. The cultured one. That's him. Last night. Far as I can remember, old girl, last night as ever was. Dimitri hasn't seen you since last Monday. He told us himself an hour ago. Magnus considered this. Tom had found a copy of the Athens News and was standing at the next table, intently studying the film page. You checked on me, Mab. You shouldn't have done that. I wasn't checking on you, I was looking for you. Don't make a scene now, girl, please. Other people eating here, you see. I'm not making a scene. You are. It's not me who disappears for 2 days and comes back with a lie. Tom, go to your room, darling. I'll be up in a minute. Tom left, smiling brightly to show he hadn't heard anything. Magnus took a long drink of coffee. Then he grasped Mary's hand and kissed it, and gently pulled her down onto the chair beside him. Which would you rather, I told you, Mabs, I was carousing with a whore, or I've got problems with a Joe? Why don't you just tell me the truth? The suggestion amused him, not cruelly or cynically. Merely, he received it with the rueful indulgence that he would show towards Tom when he came through one of his solutions for ending world poverty or the arms race. Know something? He kissed her hand again and held it against his cheek. Nothing goes away in life. To her surprise, she felt moisture in his stubble and realized he was weeping. I'm in Constitution Square, right? Coming out of the Grand Bretagne bar, minding my own business. What happens? I walk straight into the arms of a Czech Joe I used to run. Real tough egg, fabricator. Causes a lot of problems. Holds my arm like this. Colonel Manchester, Colonel Manchester. Threatens to call the police. Expose me as a British spy if I don't give him money. Says I'm the only friend he's got left in the world. Come and drink with me, Colonel Manchester, like we used to. So I did. Drank him right under the table. Then gave him the slip. I'm afraid I got a bit pissed myself. Line of duty. Let's go to bed. And they do, and make love. The desperate screwing of strangers, while Tom reads fantasy next door. And 2 days later they leave for Hydra. But Hydra is too cramped, too ominous. There is suddenly nowhere to go but Spetsai. At this time of the year, we'll have no problem. Tom asks if Becky can join them. Magnus says no, she absolutely can't, because they'll all want to come, and he's not going to have a pride of letterers sitting on his head while he's trying to write. Otherwise, apart from his drinking,
Magnus has never been more caring and polite than now. She had stopped, like standing back from a painting halfway, studying the story so far. She drank some whiskey, lit a cigarette.
"Christ," said Brotherhood, softly.
Then nothing. Nigel had found a bit of dead skin on the back of one undersized finger, and was picking it off meticulously. It is Lesbos again. It is another dawn, with the same Greek bed, and Plomari is once more waking up, though Mary is praying it will go back to sleep again, that the sounds will fade, and the sun flop behind the rooftops where it came from, because it is Monday, and yesterday Tom went back to school. Mary has the evidence under her pillow, where she promised to put the rabbit skin he gave her, to keep her safe, and, as if she needed it to strengthen her resolve, the terrible memory of his last words to her before he left. Mary and Magnus have driven him to the airport, weighed him in for yet another departure. Tom and Mary are standing about, unable to touch each other, while they wait for the flight to be called. Magnus is at the bar, buying Tom a bag of pistachios for the journey, and an ouzo for himself while he's about it. Mary has 6 times confirmed that Tom has his passport and his money, and his letter to Matron about his shrimp rash, and his letter to Granny to be handed to her the moment you meet her at London Airport, darling, so that you don't forget. But Tom is even more than usually distracted. He is looking back to the main entrance, watching the people going through the swing doors. And there is something desperate in his face, so desperate that Mary really wonders whether he is thinking of making a dash for it. "Mums?" Sometimes, when he is distracted, he still calls her that.
"Yes, darling?"
"They're here, Mums."
"Who are?"
"Those 2 campers from Plomari. They're sitting in the airport car park on their motorbike, watching Dad."
"Now, darling, just stop,"
Mary retorts firmly, determined to drive away these shadows, one and all.
"Just completely stop, okay? Only I recognize them, you see. I worked it out this morning. I remembered. They're the men who drove the car round the outside of the cricket ground at Corfu, while Dad's friend tried to make him come for a drive."
For a moment, though Mary has been through this agonizing procedure 12 times before, she wants to scream out,
"Stay, don't go, I don't care a damn about your bloody education, stay with me."
But instead, the fool waves him through the barrier and saves her tears for the journey back, while Magnus is absolutely sweet to her, as ever. And now it is next morning. Tom is just about arriving at his school, and Mary is staring at the prison bars of Kiria Katina's rotting shutters, while the sky remorselessly whitens through the cracks, and she is trying not to hear the clanking of the water pipes beneath her, and the rush of water free-falling on the flagstones, as Magnus celebrates his morning shower.
"Wowee Christ! You awake, girl? It's brass monkeys down here, believe me!"
"Believe you," she repeats to herself, and draws deeper into the bedclothes. In 15 years he never called me girl till here. Now suddenly she is girl all day, as if he has woken to her gender. A single width of floorboard separates her from him, and if she dares look over the bedside, she will glimpse his stranger's naked body through the gaps between the planks. Receiving no reply from her, Pym starts singing his one piece of Gilbert and Sullivan while he sloshes water.
"Rising early in the morning, we proceed to light the fire. How am I doing?"
he calls, when he has sung all he knows. Mary, in another life, has a small reputation for her music. In Plush, she led a passable group in madrigals. When she was doing her stint at head office, she sang solo in the firm choir.
"It's just that nobody's ever played records for you,"
she used to tell him, in a veiled criticism of his first wife, Belinda.
"One day your singing voice will be as good as your spoken one, darling."
She summons her breath.
"Better than Caruso!"
she shouts. The exchange accomplished, Magnus can resume his showering.
"It went well, Babs, really well. 7 pages of deathless prose. Undercoat, but good."
"Great."
He has started shaving. She can hear him empty the kettle into the plastic washing-up bowl.
"Contour blades," she thinks. "Oh, God, I forgot to buy him.